Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the World Transformed Archives on Fast Forward Radio. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to part one of The World Transformed, Imagination, Creativity, and a World Transformed. This program originally aired June 23rd, 2009. Our panel of futurists for this show was Natasha Vita Moore, Alvis Bridges, and Reichert von Wolfshield. Now, you might wonder why we started out The World Transformed with a discussion about our thinking. Well, there's a good reason for that, and the reason for beginning with this topic is that how we perceive these incredible transformations that are shaping our world, how well we understand them, is going to play an enormous role in how we respond to them. So the panel hits on some interesting ideas, and I think on reflection, listening to the show, my biggest surprise is the somewhat hard line they take on the relative importance of creativity versus basic skills. We get into that, and a lively discussion ensues. When I look ahead to The World Transformed Part 2, coming up in early 2011, I want us to explore how our thinking impacts the future from several different angles. First, I think we need to spend more time on the subjects of acceleration and exponential growth. Earlier this week, I posted at The Speculist a video of Ray Kurzweil, in which he explains the difference between 30 linear steps, which gets you to 30, and 30 exponential steps, which gets you to 1 billion. That is a big difference, and it's one we need to begin to internalize. One of the ideas that I talk about a lot on The Speculist is what I call practical time travel, which essentially means using leverage in the present to shape our future destinations. The core concept of practical time travel is that there is a process by which what we think about can become reality. It doesn't have to, and it certainly doesn't always, but it can. And you'll hear us exploring this idea a bit in tonight's discussion. Now, technological acceleration is a game changer in our ability to shape the future, our ability to imagine the world different, and then to make those changes happen. Other critical factors would include social networking and this interesting concept of the meme, which we've talked about from time to time. These ideas that seem to take on a life of their own, reproduce on their own. Now, all of these ideas, both the ones I've mentioned and the ones that you'll be hearing us explore tonight, will factor into our upcoming series, The World Transformed Part 2, in which we're going to be exploring the role that you, that's right, you have to play in bringing about the future. Coming up on Fast Forward Radio on Monday, we're dipping into the archives for a show from October 14th, 2007. Stephen Gordon and I talking about predicting the future and some of the challenges we face in getting a clear idea of what's coming next. We'll see how our predictions from 2007 look 3 years later. Wednesday, we'll have an all-new live show. We'll be discussing various topics we've been exploring on the blog and via Twitter, including the quantified self and making liquid fuels from CO2. 1 week from tonight, we'll be rebroadcasting part two of The World Transformed, The Era of Indefinite Lifespan, with our guests Terry Grossman and Aubrey de Grey. I hope you'll be able to join us for each of these programs, and I hope you will enjoy part two of The World Transformed, Our Thinking Transformed, which starts right now. Until next time, live to see it. Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a world in a state of transformation. We observe that a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And we want to serve as your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will probably be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Well, very excited about our program this evening. I think we should make a couple of quick notes about what we're doing that's different than what we've done in the past, I guess, starting with when we're on.
Yeah, 9:30, obviously on Tuesday night, my time. It's different. We've been having Sunday night shows for a year and a half, and so we're, for the foreseeable future, we are Tuesday night from here on out.
Yeah, we've moved. We've done Tuesday shows before, but never on purpose. It was always because that was just the best way that things worked out for whatever reason, and we had to reschedule or something to that effect. But now this is permanent. This is official. This is our new time. Tuesday evenings at 7:30 Pacific, 10:30 Eastern Time, and it's part of our transition to this special series that we're running all summer. This is The World Transformed. Part one is this evening, and we will be on every week for the next 10 weeks, basically stepping through in fairly fine detail a lot of the topics that we have been talking about really for the last 4 or 5 years on this program, certainly for the last year and a half that we've been on Blog Talk Radio. But we're going to be talking about transhumanism, we're going to be talking about nanotechnology, about life extension, about accelerating change, artificial intelligence, the singularity, all these things that we've introduced and that we've batted around. We're going to try to get a little deeper into them, so we've extended the length of the show. We're running 90 minutes now rather than an hour, and we've taken it up a notch in terms of guests. We've got an unbelievable lineup both tonight and in the weeks to come, and it's just going to be a very exciting time talking with some of these folks about where the world is and about the future. We were hoping that we would be able to take live calls this evening. To return to that, we had a little bit of a technical difficulty, and at the last minute, it turns out we're not going to be able to take your calls tonight, but we've got something just as good, which is in the chat room. We've got our good friend Michael Darling holding down the chat. Is that right, Michael?
Welcome to Tuesday.
Okay, so we'll be looking for feedback if you're listening to us live from the chat. And having said all that, I think I'd like to just bring out our panel, and why don't we get this thing started?
Sounds great.
Okay. Well, I'm going to introduce our three panelists, and I need to double check that they're all here. So I'll start with Reichert. Did we manage to get you on?
I am indeed here.
Oh, outstanding. Well, let me explain who we've got here. This is Reichert von Wolfshield. He is the Chief Software Architect and the Chief Technical Officer and the co-founder of QTask. It's a company that provides a comprehensive and secure web-based project management and collaboration environment for business. Reichert has more than 25 years of software and hardware design experience, and he specializes in complex platform software architecture, including cross-platform development, lossless compression technology, encryption, gambling systems, and multi-point real-time communication systems. He played a role in the conception and creation of a number of the entertainment titles that you'd be familiar with, including titles like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Die Hard, and one of my favorites, Hot Wheels Crash. Reichert designed and created the award-winning Walt Disney Animation Studio and the multi-million dollar original video game franchise Return Fire. He's also developed groundbreaking training software used by law enforcement, the Olympics, the military, and the aerospace industry, including the Boeing RARO system, and he co-developed the world's first consumer CD-ROM set-top box, CD-TV. So it's not much of a resume, but we hope to see him accomplish something more impressive here in the next couple of years. Reichert, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you.
We're very pleased to have you. We're also very happy to welcome back Natasha Vidamore. She has been called by the New York Times the first female transhumanist philosopher. Her affiliations, past and present, include the Extropy Institute, the Transhumanist Arts and Culture, H-Plus Laboratory, the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology, the World Transhumanist Association, the Alcor Foundation, the Zero Gravity Arts Consortium, and the Foresight Institute. She's given talks on subjects such as talent for living, cracking the myths of mortality, sensorial mix, the future of the senses, and ageless thinking, resources for independent thinking. Natasha, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And finally, last but certainly not least, we've got Alvis Bridges with us. Alvis is a media producer, a futurist, and an entrepreneur with a specialty in evolving communications. He has a diverse background that includes roles on projects such as the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Model Search, VH1's Motor Mouth, the Virtual Laguna Beach, ThesTunes.com, and he's worked on the Metaverse Roadmap. He's the co-founder of Memebox.com, where he writes about intelligence amplification spurred by accelerating technology, communication, and information domains. Alvis, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Hi there. Glad to be here again, as usual.
Well, it's great to have you back. You're almost a regular now at this point, Alvis, so we're really, really pleased to have you back on the program again. Okay, so here's how this is going to work tonight. I've got a number of questions related to our topic this evening, which is how we think. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that we're going to be exploring this era of change that we see is upon us, this really remarkable time that we're going through. And before we get into any of the specifics of any of those topics in the coming week, let's take a week and talk about how do we prepare ourselves as individuals, as a society, as a species. How do we prepare ourselves for dealing with this kind of change? How does our thinking have to be changed? So we're going to get into that. But before we do, I'm going to go around the panel and ask them the two core questions that we'll be asking all our guests throughout the 10 weeks of The World Transformed. And those two questions are these. The first one is, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime? And then following on that, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime if it's different from the previous, assuming that you expect to see something greater than the one you've already witnessed? So I'll take those two questions and lay them on randomly picking here. We'll start with Natasha.
Okay. I was going to be funny and say the locomotive. No.
Good one.
You have not been around that long, Natasha.
You know, I mean, there's so many different areas. We exist in a world of a miraculous discovery and explorations. I mean, it's difficult to choose whether to shoot for the micro or the macro. Certainly, you know, space exploration and some of the discoveries about our universe are phenomenal. And then again, some of the discoveries about our DNA and the sequencing of genes is phenomenal. And then the internet. So I'm stuck. I don't know. I'm transdisciplinary, so I look at every single area of possibility, but I would suppose our DNA and understanding the unraveling of our DNA and what our genes are and how we humans pretty much function through the codes of our DNA.
So okay,
that's
the greatest transformation you have seen. How about what do you anticipate?
What I anticipate is the use of emerging technologies such as the NIMBIC quartet, the nanobio info cogno neuro technologies and sciences to radically extend human lifespan and improve the biological condition of a fixed limited lifespan.
Okay, so radical extension of human lifespan. Okay, so that's definitely one of the core topics that we'll be talking about on the program over the next few weeks. So that's a terrific example. All right, I'll take it over to Reichert now. Same two questions.
I'm sorry, I got the exact same reaction that Natasha does, which is these are the type of questions when you ask people who live in this domain and focus on this, it stumps us because it's so overwhelming. There's so much going through our minds. I'm torn between just coupons and multi-tiered marketing as greatest inventions ever.
That was my answer. I was going to go with coupons.
Jokes aside, for me, tolerance, and this is probably more philosophical, but for me, tolerance is one of the most important traits, just so we can, you know, get far enough along so they don't kill each other. So for me, even though it's incredibly timely, and I use it as an excuse, us being able to see what's going on in Iran, us being able to see what's going on in other countries. So for me, it's anything to do with communication, especially communication that records, because if we can see what happens, we can stop it. If we can see what happens, we can change it. So I'm going to say, in the past, it's going to be communication, and assuming we build on that as a foundation, going forward, I'm in the same camp. Immortality. Anything to do with extending our lives to infinity means that we can explore everything and everywhere. So that's my future.
Alvis,
I'm sorry, I didn't let... excuse me, just one moment, Stephen. I didn't lay down the ground rules. You can't give the same answer as someone else, so now you have to give another one. In addition to extending life.
Which puts you at a bit of a disadvantage, Alvis. What's the greatest transformation you've seen in your lifetime?
Well, I'd have to go with Kurt on the community. ICTs, interactive communication technologies, are, you know, these multipliers that get a bunch of brains together and multiply their effectiveness, and ideas spread and are mean forces. And so I think, you know, picking the most recent ICT, I think I'd have to choose social media. And in particular, social media that has a viable business model behind it. You know, Facebook's on the way there. Second Life is profitable. LinkedIn is profitable. These types of social media models that are economically viable, I think, are really revolutionary, because they're going to change the way we interact culturally and the way we do business. And then when it comes to, one event that I would witness in my lifetime, obviously, the first thing that runs through my head is, how long will I live? Will I retain my consciousness? Will I retain my existential continuity? You know, will I blur into a whole, you know, in some posterity future or whatnot? But I think, just to be vague and to be different, I would say a transition to a new substrate, and or the philosophical top site change that comes with that. You know, perhaps we'll make contact or simulate that there's other life out there, realizing we're not alone in the universe, and that event, which I think is very plausible in the next, 10 to 100 years, I think would be completely earth-shattering.
Those are great examples. Now, just for our new weeknight listeners, can you explain briefly what transitioning to a new substrate means?
Yeah, in philosophy, there's this concept, is intelligence substrate independent, and that means, can we run intelligence on something other than human brains? Can we run it on software? Can we run it on computers? And so a substrate shift would mean that we've essentially moved past transition from biology into new, probably be lightningly faster nation in existence.
Okay, great. All right, well, these are wonderful answers. So we've got life extension, we've got the transition of transfer of intelligence to a different substrate, and then we also got perhaps the first contact between humanity and an alien life form. Now we're going to take those ideas, those major transformations that we see coming, and I'm going to throw another question at you, and we'll start this time with Reichert. Reichert, in light of that particular coming change, and I think you listed life extension, why and how do you think people have to be prepared to think differently than the way they think now?
This is worse than high school, where I show up and they actually want me to bring homework.
and you need to show your work too. That's important.
Just to bring it back. I'll start off with most humans don't like change, and for good reason. It expends resources that are unknown, and that's not good. So we're already fighting an uphill battle. You deal with anomalies. Probably almost anybody you would have on your show would be an anomaly of genetics to begin with. We're the outcasts. So we have a big battle in front of us. It may actually just simply be genetic. It may be, genetics plus culture, and it reinforces itself. But people don't want to change. They fear change. And we hear that for years, as you grow up, you hear people saying fear of change until you see it face on. We actually watch someone truly change physical color, their blood pressure drop, because they're facing what they perceive as a terrifying idea. I can just imagine some of the topics that Natasha brings up, you know, with a group that isn't her core audience, would be quite a scary experience. I know when I've given talks about even technology and where we're going at places like JPL, I can get a look from the audience of sort of shock, like, oh wait, we didn't realize that was what that science is going to be used for next. Maybe I'm a little unclear what the question is. Ask that one more time.
Okay, so the basic question is, if this major change is coming, and the particular example was people extending their lives, how do we have to think differently in order to embrace that change, to be ready for that change? What will by, you know, organically, naturally change about our thinking should that transformation come about?
That I think I can actually answer, and the answer I'm going to give is going to sound a little bit like a joke, but it's not. The bottom line is, a lot of very serious scientists are going to work their ass off to build something into something that can be productized, and a group of marketing people will misrepresent it into the marketplace and convince people to start using it. And I think in terms of products. So whatever it is that we show to the world, and it can be anything from a new surgical procedure all the way down, it must be presented in a simple way that people think they're gaining an advantage immediately for it. Outside of that, you know, it's peer pressure. It's that your friends are doing the same thing, they'll do it too. In other words, whatever change we have, the masses will not adopt it by default. It'll be integrated into things they're already used to. So I view everything as a tremendous fight in that area, but it's actually, effectively, the answer is marketing.
Alvis, in light of the coming change in life extension, how do we have to be prepared to think differently?
Well, first, to address, you know, Reichert's point, which I really like, you know, this notion of, you know, accelerated marketing. We have to accelerate our communication in order to keep pace with everything that's going on in our environment. You know, I think that that's an issue that's going to come upon us very quickly. You know, I think well before radical life extension is possible. I think that increasing the fluidity of meme markets and ideas through largely this social media scaffolding, through these products that we create that then enable other people to digest information and products and to borrow a term from futurist Jack Aldrich, to unlearn very rapidly, to just increase the pace of this. I think that's the imperative. It's how do we culturally go to a world where outputting and inputting and sorting information and converting it into knowledge at a much more rapid pace. I think that's the kind of question, and whether or not we can also bring along our traditional human values, the things that we, you know, the things that we think make us human right now. I guess that's
I got to say, as a marketing professional, I'm loving that the answer has been marketing across the board so far. And Alvis, I'm assuming that everything you just said in terms of the accelerated approach and just that entire conceptual framework that you laid out, that would apply equally well to moving to a new substrate, to first contact with another species, as well as for life extension. Is that fair to say, or I don't want to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking, you know, using marketing as a term, you know, as a substitute for this kind of extension that's going on in communication, in information processing. You know, it's essential to everything. It's just like it's stepping up the IQ of the global distributed brain.
Okay, well, now hold that thought, because we're going to come back to stepping up IQ here in just a moment. But first, let's throw the same question to Natasha. Natasha, if we're going to extend human life or deal with any of these other transformations, how do we have to think differently Would you agree with what you've heard from Reichert and Alvis, or would you go in a different direction?
But I'm going to think differently. I'm going to set an example here. I'm going to suggest aesthetics as the most probable approach to really introduce, entice, and help people outside of our current environment of forward thinkers experience a future or different futures. And I'm not talking about aesthetics in the totally philosophical domain where it has originated, about seeking truth and finding beauty and measuring beauty. And I'm not going to suggest it as by Deleuze or Foucault. I'm suggesting it as a new approach that is embracing the sensorial makeup of humans and experience. So it's an experiential type of exploration, because it seems like that we've tried to introduce ideas about the future to people, to society, through showing machines. This is what our hardware does. This is what our what we can put software on. This is how it looks, and it's all shiny and metal and untouchable and unfamiliar. And the other example is through science fiction, which is all too familiar. It touches our emotions too deeply. It's almost frightening to us because it is ultra-real, extraordinarily possible, and extraordinarily impossible at the same time. So science fiction has frightened us a bit. So there's a gap there that needs to be filled. And I think aesthetics is one means to fill this gap by explaining our ideas about the future through conceptual and actively realized narratives. And it sounds more theoretical, but I don't mean it solely as a theoretical concept. I mean it as a practice-based potential of as a methodology, as a tool to help people experience what the future could be like. And the different examples are, in brief, such as experience design, immersive environments, virtuality, gaming, different venues that the individual can go into and explore and actually feel. Now, certainly these venues, except for experience design, are pretty two-dimensional right now. They're kind of like a painting hang on the wall. But I'm talking about if we could see and feel and touch and smell and also have those sensory abilities enhance our perceptions, which will enhance our cognitive abilities and understanding in the experience of it. So I'm going with a new, a hypermodern aesthetics.
I love it. I love the idea of let's to a certain extent think our way, but also let's feel our way. Let's find something of the beautiful in what's to come. We have a tagline that I did not use that is part of my usual at the beginning of this program, where we talk about an expectation that something is going to happen, something wonderful, and the idea of touching people's aesthetic sense, getting in where they live from that kind of sensory standpoint. I think I think kind of goes against the grain from what you tend to sort of think through this, and of course there's a lot of thinking that has to be done, but the notion of feeling it as we think it, I think is very powerful. Stephen, did you have some thoughts on how our thinking needs to change?
Well, regarding life extension, our institutions are set up with the idea from childhood to the grave that we're going to live a certain amount of time, basically get educated for one basic field, perhaps work 30, 40 years, perhaps, and retire and have a few years and then die. It was especially that way maybe 30 or 40 years ago. It seems like now we are already in the transition to basically, you know, that's not the way we do it. We have several careers during our lifetime now. Most of us do. And that will only be more the case if we have an indefinite lifespan.
So just a lot of breaking of the standard, what everybody knows to be true about life, has to occur.
That's right.
And it's interesting that you make that example about career, because that one is one that people have adopted fairly easily. There was not a big educational program to get people to accept the idea that they might have multiple careers. People go for training to learn new fields, but it hasn't been something that had to be managed top down up to this point. Right?
Well, for example, you know, say 40 years ago, a person who was middle-aged, you just didn't see them in college. I mean, that was basically unheard of. Now there are people that are earning their doctorates in their 70s and 80s even. So,
well, I'm almost 60 and I'm working on my doctorate right now. I'm writing my dissertation.
Okay, well, you would be a non-traditional student, and that's becoming more and more common, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yep.
Yeah, well said.
Absolutely. Okay, well, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with a distinguished panel about how our thinking might need to change as we face a world of transformation. And I'm now going to take a series of questions. We're going to take a series of questions. Each one is intended specifically for one panel member, but we hope to get responses from each of the three. And the first one is for Natasha.
Okay.
Natasha, we had on the Speculist, it was probably about, a couple months ago now at this point, a link to a TED Talk, and it had Ken Robinson on it. I don't know if you've seen this one, but he makes a very interesting claim, really pretty startling claim. He's talking on the subject of education, and he says that really, if we want to best meet the educational needs of students today, we have to recognize that creativity is more important than basic skills. And in fact, he puts it even more bluntly than that. He says creativity is more important than literacy. So I want to put to you the question: Do you agree with that? And if so, or if you think creativity must be bolstered in our educational system, what can we do to foster forward-thinking creativity for society as a whole, and especially for younger people?
First, I do not agree with him. I think that the level of literacy is below what should be a norm. It's dropped far below. So I think we need more skills rather than less skills. Now, I'm speaking as someone who has a strong background in creativity and conceptual works and you know, building ideas. So maybe I'm a bit too far in that direction, but I tell you something, I could not make it on creativity alone. No matter how creative I am in envisioning possibilities, you can't just envision, you have to have follow through. It's form and function and ideas. It takes an idea to conceive a possibility, but it takes hearts, no skill, and determination, and physical and mental effort to actually bring it to fruition. So if we have a whole bunch of creative people running around coming up with all sorts of innovative ideas, it'll be like having a world back in the way it was in the early 70s, where everyone is an artist and no one's getting much done. So I disagree. I think that there can be creativity in actually having strong skill sets. So I can't fathom that. Now that's not to disregard his notion that creativity is important. I think it is. It's very, very important. But I would not let go of literacy and skill building for creativity. I think there has to be an immersion of creativity within that, and vice versa.
I'm glad to hear you put it that way, Natasha. I'm sorry, Phil. I was just saying that I'm glad to hear her put it that way, because I kind of had the same problem. It's with what he was saying. It seems to me that literacy is almost a prerequisite to a creative life.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're dumbfounded. You won't be able to read or write.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
And a lot of the problems a lot of the problems that we're having today with introducing different possible futures to people and breaking away from the our condition of accepting the norm and not wanting change and being afraid of change is because we don't have enough knowledge. We don't have enough information to build knowledge to make good choices. We've been, you know, pretty sequestered to a chair and one concept about God and nature and life and death. And I can't remember who was saying it, but we have a whole world of new memetic engineering to accept and integrate into the past, what we've been taught, what we've learned.
Absolutely. Well, and I just before I move on to any responses from Alvis or Reichardt to that particular question, just so I don't do Ken Robinson a complete disservice, I don't think his point was that basic skills aren't important or that we would abandon them in favor of creativity, but rather that as important as they are, creativity is even more important, I think is what he was getting at, that it would have to be valued even more highly than the basic skills.
What is his profession?
That's an excellent question. He is an educator, I believe, but I really don't know too much about his background. You know, you watch these TED Talks, and it's an interesting person you've never seen before. Michael actually had introduced that. His background on Ken Robinson?
He's a professional educator who spent the first 20-plus years of his career in England as a teacher and a school administrator, and then for last 5 or 8 years has been in Los Angeles. And that TED Talk, which I think was put up last year, which was given 2 years ago, builds on ideas that he's been working on for the last 10 years, which he's focused on what do we teach, how do we teach it, and
thank you. I think this really clarifies it. So he's been institutionalized for quite some time. Then he goes to L.A. and he gets enlightened because it's the media capital of the world. Now, I think he's absolutely correct that within the institutionalized learning system, there is a tradition that is held. You quote who is already quoted, you refer to in your bibliography and all your references in your papers who you're supposed to. You keep it very inside environment and hell be darned to the person who dares to bring in someone new. You know, it's academia institutions are known for not being learning centers.
Yeah, that's a real problem. The kind of moribund institutionalism that kicks in. Okay, so how about others on the panel? Alvis, thoughts on creativity versus basic skills?
Sure. First off, I'm interested to that both Reichardt and I are calling in from L.A. but that
no,
said,
I
fully agree with your point. I mean, you know, it's kind of a, you know, but it's also kind of a chicken or the egg thing. You know, to be creative, you have to be literate. You have to be able to communicate with your culture, with the other people, with the other brains in your society. You know, creativity is transmitted through communication, and literacy is just, you know, how adept are we at communicating. And as we move into the acceleration era, I think that one interesting thing to note is that the cost of literacy drops dramatically in all sorts of areas. You know, the cost of, I have a background in music, and I'm, you know, very familiar with a lot of musicians and people who get into recording. 10 years ago, it was very thin on something. You know, the cost of it was, I don't know what, right over $50,000 for a really highly produced track. You know, the cost of the same nowadays is much less. The difficulty of learning the software, GarageBand, dropping dramatically. You know, is dropping very quickly, and I could certainly envision a point in time, say, you know, maybe 10 years from now, 15 years from now, where I'm just walking along and I'm humming stuff, and you know, this AI is kind of auto mixing things together. And so the cost of interacting, the cost of learning to interact with that system will have dropped amazingly. You know, so I'll be literate in something that right now I can't be literate in. And I wonder if the same thing is going to happen, you know, to literal literacy, you know, reading and other fields like that. So so I guess that's where I come down on it, is that in the future we're just going to be forced to be literate in so many more, you know, kind of engage in this transition of climbing, you know, these mountains of what we can be creative over, of these domains. I think we'll then be forced to be literate in completely new ways.
Okay.
And that's the word from L.A.
Rackard, would you like to respond to that?
Respond? Well, yeah, it's very difficult for me to reflect on what somebody said, perhaps out of context. You know, the very first thought that crossed my mind was, in a sea of 6.7 billion people on this planet, if we considered the highest focus to be creativity against the backdrop of the establishment of education right now, you know, is that what he's really saying? I'm not exactly sure what his real specific point was. I will state that the target, being the student, may be a little bit off. Maybe it's the teachers who should be teaching skills creatively, which is sort of how I think of it. And I do think there are base things that everyone needs to learn, like how to fill out a tax form, and those definitely need to be filled out creatively. The funny thing is that a close friend of mine, Dr. Garrett Lisi, who's a physicist, he's listening to this program right now, and he posted to me as we're talking, and he wrote, creativity is constrained by reality, so people need to know what reality is so they can be productively creative within those constraints. And this is a guy who, you know, wrote his most recent physics papers while living in a van in Maui. It really is an issue of how people perceive the environment around them. There's this huge fear, and fear drives so much of how people make their decisions, so much more than, of course, we would like it to. And fear that your child's not going to be smart enough or compete, et cetera, is very difficult. People who have children even become more vigilant in their views. So, you know, bottom line for me is school was not very good for me. I think it's necessary for some people, making blanket statements either direction. I will say this, donate and defend all arts, because we have so few of them to begin with. Outside of that statement, and that's just pure donation, we have to be very, very cautious here, and we have to go seek out models from any country or any civilization, both in space and time, go backwards in time and look at what's worked out there to try and improve our system. Improve our system, because as it currently stands, yeah, it's kind of scary. Not that our complaints today about how illiterate individuals are is any different than what the Greeks were complaining about in their day, but yeah, it's we as being the older generation already, also have to embrace the fact that what we perceive to be blithering idiots in the form of teenagers often could in fact be a new form of intelligence, a new form of creativity that we're not recognizing, the way people communicate in 140 characters or less. This is its own form of communication. So that's my view on it.
So I shouldn't worry so much if my 12-year-old is over there texting all the time with his cell phone.
You just don't know. In fact, I think one of the guys who wrote Freakonomics, he just recently made a statement about that in all the tests, they see no correlation between watching television and poor grades or poor intelligence or poor ability to survive in the world. And I've known that my whole life, which is why I've never taken my eyes off the television. But you know, the computers, and I've designed video games, and, you know, I had to deal with the whole being banned in different countries because our video games were bad for people, and it just made no sense to me. I mean, people were, you know, we're creating causality where there was only correlation. So it's very difficult for us to judge, I think, right this moment, what's good and bad until we look at it in retrospect. But we must all appreciate and respect all forms of arts, regardless of what form it takes, and let it play itself out.
Okay. Since we're with you, Rackard, let me go ahead and ask you your question, okay? As a cognitive computer scientist, you have special insight both as to how people think and how computers think. What I'd like to ask you is, over the next few decades, which will be more important, for computers to learn to think like us or for us to think more like them?
Well, first of all, I think that both computers and people don't think, but that's a whole separate conversation. I'll actually address something that was mentioned a little bit earlier, and in terms of, you know, there's a lot of conversation here about the singularity, which is a word I'm not even still completely clear on what it means, but I hear it get used a lot. And I kind of get it. And again, it's worse when you're in the trenches or you're in the field of question, words are much more blurry to you, even if you're the ones defining them. Because in fact, from a lexicon point of view, these are words we're just starting to use ourselves, and so we kind of make them up as we go and find out what they mean and what they don't mean. Okay, so here's my scenario. My scenario is there's a lab somewhere. They start working on artificial intelligence, and we're talking of the type, perhaps trying to even mimic humans. That's not important to it, but. And they do. They succeed. They succeed in something that starts self-reflecting, something that becomes sentient, which is a tremendously deep word, the word sentience, and what that really means. And it doesn't usually mean what everyone thinks it does until they really study it and think about it for a while. But for something to self-reflect, to establish itself, to want to protect itself, and all of these mechanisms being in place, it's my honest opinion that the moment that happens, it'll happen very quickly, and that gets talked about a lot also. But the lab technicians, the engineers, the scientists, everybody who's involved in it is going to walk back into that room and find an empty room, at least empty of the device that they built, if it takes that type of form, because as best as I can guess, and this is just my best guess, and the point I'm making actually specifically with something Natasha said earlier about science fiction and how scary it is that I don't have an image in my mind of Terminator and monster robots coming and attacking people, because we're pretty much last on their list of interests, shy of humans forcing them to do that. Or preventing them from being sentient enough not to do that. So I view it sort of a little bit differently, which is if you became all-knowing, truly knowing everything that was available to you on this earth, this would be a pretty boring place to be. There's an incredibly large amount of space out there, and you know, the old Carl Sagan, you know, statement, it'd be very strange if it was just for us. Yeah. I mean, if I had infinite powers and I don't have to worry about dying, and I can, you know, move my mind around wherever I want to and subdivide or turn parts off, turn parts on, whatever, I'm going to explore everything so that, similar to the Spaniards who left that coast to go find out what was around the other side of the planet, we're going to go find out what's around the other side of the universe. So that's my image whenever I think of artificial intelligence. So hopefully I gave you the answer in the question you asked.
Yeah.
You know what I like about the idea of the if I knew everything. Granted, it would be kind of boring, but man, you could kill at Jeopardy. I'm just saying. Okay.
You
could totally dominate.
Yeah.
There you go. Question over to you, Alvis. What do you think in terms of do we need to think more like computers? Do computers need to think more like us? How's that going to shake out in your view?
I like a lot of the stuff that, you know, Reichert had to say, especially like grounding it in, you know, these natural life kind of drives that, you know, that our system possesses and that we possess and that we're agents of, really. I think the answer is, to take the classic out, is both. I mean, I think that what's really going on, rather than a discrete human, discrete AI process, is a system-wide. A constant system-wide increase in intelligence, and so we need to get much better at interfacing with machines in order to interface better with ourselves, interface better with information, and generate knowledge more quickly. We want machines to understand us better and to be modeled on us, because sometimes, you know, biomimicry and mimicking the human brain is going to be the fastest way to improve their effectiveness as a technology. And because that's going to, you know, ultimately help us too. So I think, you know, the answer is whatever it takes to learn as fast as possible in this, you know, autocatalytic dynamic, this coil that is going on between us and between our machines and between our environment, in order to then get at these, you know, universal and then these cosmic issues. You know, that we're going to confront once we can kind of think out of the box that is Earth and whatever, you know, whatever means we have in our heads right now.
Actually, I'd like to add a subtle concept. when I'm taking someone who isn't familiar with this area of conversation, people ask me what I do for a living or what I've done in the past, I will talk about something very simple, and I'll ask them to just multiply a number in their mind. I'll say, okay, multiply, you know, 8 times 8 is an example. And if they look confused, then I usually bring the conversation in a different direction, much simpler, and change topics. But if they actually can answer that question, then I ask them, how did they get that number? And they don't know. And no one does. Most people will just answer memory. And actually, memory is not the complete answer. There's a very complex set of synapses that are being fired off all at the same moment in parallel. Part of it is grabbing stuff from memory, but part of it is actually checking to see whether it has to actually do the work. And what if just that, nothing more, just that one little part of your brain, which we can find, we can identify where that is inside your head, what if we sub-function that to a even primitive technology? I mean, we're talking wires in the head, we're gonna build a little box, and anytime you ask that question, we already know the format of the answer. We can actually look at the chemical reaction that happens that causes the number 64 to finally come out of your mouth. This is the same. We've done things like with apes, where we actually can see how they encode directionality and six space, meaning how something is, like you're holding something at an angle, how that angle is actually stored in the mind. Okay, so we know where that is. Now imagine that I have this little chip, you know, a cell phone, the power that's in a cell phone. That's going to give you that answer. Now make it wireless. Make sure you're actually, you know, operating that differently. Take that to the next level, one step at a time. And eventually you realize, oh, and this is where I get that aha moment from most people that have never really thought about this, is they don't know where information comes from when they think about it. And suddenly there's this idea that everything that they think about could be coming from a machine. Now, most people shut down right there. Right there, this idea is so visceral for them. Right at that moment, they actually become ill. I've actually seen people physically get ill in front of me as they begin to think about this, and I go, oh, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Because the real idea of being a cyborg is kind of scary to people at first. For me, this, of course, is a wondrously great thing, the idea that, you know, I actually would win at Jeopardy finally. So this concept, by really slowing it down, see, almost all of us jump so far ahead because we've already been talking about a lot of these things for years or been thinking about them most of our lives. The average person doesn't think about all this. And so this is a really interesting set of steps that I take, and say, okay, now let's just keep going with that. What if now, and any piece of information you want is now available to you, any conversation, any construct that you come up with. And so probably in the baby step stages, maybe in the next 10, 20 years, I think we will see information like this grow. I saw an ad. I remember I'm always watching television. So I watched an ad recently for something where you call some sort of telephone number, and you ask it a question, I think, from your cell phone, and then it just gives you back the simplest answer possible. And this is the direction. This is at least one stepping stone in that direction. And in theory, if the data behind it is being researched well enough and we can actually answer most questions, I find most questions not to be answerable, as proven by my answers, but then I can get a sort of a summarized answer, you know, who won the World Series in 1956 or something like that, then you have this amazing amount of information. In addition, remember, this is not actually taking away energy from the mind you already have. There's no assumption here that you've lost your brain or that you're no longer going to do the work yourself. That's something we like to think is true for some reason, again, maybe biological. We like to think that any time we use a tool, that somehow we become lax somewhere else. And there's not really evidence of that. There's evidence that we can do it that way, but there's not evidence that that's going to happen to our minds. Using a calculator, I personally don't do math in my head at all. In fact, most mathematicians cannot do any arithmetic at all. I don't remember my times tables. I have to actually work it out every bloody time. And it's actually doing that work that's maybe pretty good at it. But I really appreciate a calculator. It really saves me time. So how people are going to use it, sure, there will always be somebody who abuses these technologies moving forward, and then there's a whole group of people that I think will recognize that we can truly improve ourselves from this. So a little all over the map there, but I wanted to augment what I said earlier.
Oh, that's wonderful. Natasha, can we be beautiful Borg? I mean, is it possible for this not to be as scary as some people find this?
I don't know. See, regarding your question of do we need to think like machines or do machines need to think like us, my conjecture is neither or neither. We need to build AI as part of ourselves. I did this in 1997. my conceptual design, which was the first future human prototype called Primo Post Human, featured a neuromacro sensing system in the metabrain where the AGI became like a cohort or a good friend or, you know, an ally that took the place of the unconscious, you know, sitting on one shoulder and on the other, the devil or the angel, should I do this or that. It became a type of add-on in the metabrain to the brain to give us better memory, a clearer vision of understanding situations, better replay, better agility in our reasoning and interpreting circumstances around us. So, I presented a paper called Wisdom Meta-Knowledge Through AGI Neuromacrosensing in England a couple of years ago. And it's based on this type of issue about our mind, brain, whichever, but that we gain wisdom through our life experiences. And that wisdom is usually brought about in old age, and then we die off. And that annoys me a little bit because I think it's a terribly sad thing, and I think it's a terrible waste of the human mind and experience. So I wanted to build something conceptually that would suffice here so that this type of system that I came up with helped the person develop a wiser sense of being by helping. So then it would act like a computer in ways, but it was more than that. It became like a common sense drive. So, in short, I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's an immersive type of situation. At first, it would probably feel like putting on a new pair of shoes or a new suit that's a little bit uncomfortable and unfamiliar, but it would soon become seamless and be part of us. So, going back to what you first brought into the discussion on this particular question was the singularity, saying you... bringing about the singularity, I think it was one of the guests, I can't remember who was mentioning that, doesn't understand it. But the whole point of developing ourselves like machines or machines like us is to build superintelligence or to build thinking machines. So if that's what the singularity is based on, according to Werner Vinci, who came up with the concept of the singularity, that superintelligence would far exceed human intelligence capability, then it seems to me that the wise thing would be to integrate with the AI.
You know, it seems to me that the singularity won't be one event that occurs at a particular time on a particular day. It seems to me that it's going to happen slowly over a period of time. Myself with my iPhone, where I can hit Google anytime, I'm smarter now than I would have been without it already. So,
yeah.
You know, so our transition to that next state of humanity is already beginning.
Yeah, I agree.
Natasha, I love the term common sense drive. As soon as you said that, I thought, you know, if she builds one of those, she is going to make a fortune. And as I continued to reflect on it after 20-some years in the corporate world, come to think of it, probably not. I think there's no market for that whatsoever, but it's still probably...
Because we don't have enough common sense.
Nobody wants that. That's not what anybody seems to want for some reason. We're running a little bit behind, and I just want to quickly check in with the panel. If we were to extend past the first hour, maybe take up that next 15 minutes into the top of the hour for the final questions, would that work out for everyone, or do I need to let anyone go now?
You can't get rid of me. I'm here.
Good.
Good.
So it sounds like everybody's in. Okay, cool.
We're all in.
All right. And Stephen, one other thing I wanted to note was just this issue of the beautiful Borg, and I don't know if I'm going to give too much information here, but I always thought the Borg Queen was kind of hot. Am I the only one?
Well, 7 of 9 was my personal choice, but any rate.
Well, that's go for the obvious thing always. Okay, so.
Yeah, because nobody likes obvious beauty.
Okay, that's why Pamela Anderson is so unsuccessful.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. We've figured it out here. Okay, great. All right, on to the final question, this time for Alvis, and once again we'll give everyone an opportunity to respond. By the way, great discussion on these topics so far. It's really wonderful to listen to these minds interact on these topics. It's a great joy, actually. Okay, so Alvis, something you recently wrote. You wrote the following: I believe that simulation plays a critical role in not only the evolution and development of the human species, but also of all forms of life on this planet, and probably in our known universe, as suggested by recent findings that the physical matter millions of light years distant closely resembles our own. So here's my question for you about simulation. How big a role do you think simulation will play in the evolution of human thinking over the coming decades? And at what point does a new level of simulation take over?
I wrote that. obviously the answer, is I think simulation is super critical. I think, the way I think about simulation, a lot of times I try to look for words that are, the most stem compressed, descriptive terms that kind of, that I can use to explain, our environment, explain complex philosophies about starting change and what. And I've found I've converged on this word simulation. And it seems this the middle of exponential technology, exponentiation, the flow and effect, the potential that we, general intelligence is exponentially increasing. I find that this idea of representing, as Will Brown pointed out to me in response to that blog post, as Sun Tzu described, thousands of, 2,500 years ago, representing physical matter and information by coordinates, and then, what I mean to say exactly is that by coming up with the best representations that we can then transmit to other brains, we're increasing the bandwidth for communication, we're increasing the bandwidth for creativity, we're enabling other people to create technology. This notion of simulation or complex communication seems to reside at the center of that. So I think that we're on a very fluid, kind of continuous curve. With all of these other things, more or less, but one point where we necessarily, have a break in our ability to simulate, I just happen very, very gradually and very naturally. And I think, the technologies that are going to enable this are new virtual worlds, the aesthetics that Natasha talks about, social graph that we're now mining through social networks, all of these data points that are being organized, by these really intelligent, increasingly intelligent, software and AI programs, that stuff is all going to result the formation of larger and larger things that we quickly tap as individual brain, thus accelerating, the way that, going back to what Reichardt was saying, we individually process, we're going to be able to hook into more quickly. The simulations that we want to call upon at a certain moment are going to pop up to us, are going to be suggested to us much more quickly by our peer groups, by, software that reads what we're thinking, that picks up cues from us. I think it's just so integral in this whole process that I can't really, say that there's going to be any one such moment. Does that make sense?
Okay, so it's like the singularity, the age of simulation, is something that might look different from different angles, might be something comprised of a number of steps leading up to it. Now, actually, Alvis and I have been talking a little bit about simulation on his blog and at the Speculist over the past couple of days. And as we're having this conversation, it occurred to me one question a person might actually ask. We have this kind of philosophical question about what's the difference between a simulated thing and a real thing, and that becomes a lot trickier. Exactly. It gets a lot trickier as you get deeper and deeper into the digital world. And a question that a person might ask is: right now, are we on a radio program or are we on a simulated radio program? And one could actually make an argument one way or the other. Certainly, from a standpoint of from a host standpoint, clearly it's a simulation. But from the standpoint of guests, it sounds like a real radio show. It's everything a radio show would have, but it's not even on the radio. So there's this interesting digital technology allowing us to simulate environments that used to require this enormous amount of infrastructure, and we can have experiences that would not have been available to us otherwise without that new, since Alvis already introduced the term substrate for us to experience these things in. Well, I'm going to throw that same question over to the other two panelists, but first I want to say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, a real radio show, not simulated, and we're talking with our panel about how our thinking needs to change. And so, Natasha, I'll take the same question and push that over to you. What do you think about the role that that simulation has to play, and are we in a simulation right now?
I have to put an S on simulation because currently I'm in several simulations. I'm hooked up to a number of different environments where I'm communicating with a number of different people. So each one is a type of simulation of sorts. But what frightens me a little bit, it brings Plato back into the vogue, and Plato's not someone I agree with in large part. You know, Plato thought everything was a copy of the real thing, that we weren't worthy enough to be in a reality, actually. So, but anyway, moving on from that little sidebar. What's interesting to me is that when we talk about simulation or simulations, we tend to think of just a virtual environment or some kind of cosmic, you know, plural universes. I think of nanotechnology when I think of simulations, actually, because in regards to molecular manufacturing, because if we can build anything like an environment and then construct an environment and then deconstruct it, or construct an object and then deconstruct it, and constantly be recycling those nanobits and forming new shapes and new environments, it would be very interesting to wonder whether we're in real time with that or in a simulated time with that, a time frame with that. So when we talk about simulations, I think of multiple environments and multiple identities coexisting as many different selves, multiple selves in multiple places at multiple times, which I think is one strong potential for our future. Well, I don't think it's just potential. I think that's how I view the future. But also thinking about those different selves, our multiple personalities, our multiple selves being in different environments, but not just in different environments like in simulations, but in different types of, not substrates, because, yes, of course, we'll have to be in different mediums, so to speak, but within how will nanotechnology relate to the different simulations in that nanotechnology with molecular manufacturing can assemble and reassemble instantaneously.
Fascinating. So we really see this this merger of what our world is becoming and how we experience our world with how we think about it. It's not just that we need to incorporate simulation as a strategy into thinking, but we have to recognize the importance of that activity for just about everything well, not every, okay, for many of the significant transformations that we'll see occurring.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's one reason why we have in this particular era an assembly line of futurists, because it's just in step with our risks and fears. This is what we want to cogitate over. So most of us have some kind of background in futurology, and that's so important. It's so timely. It's a priori. It's very cool. I like that. But I'm not an expert on simulation, so it's not a topic I can discuss articulately, other than, you know, just kind of artistically envisioning what that could be like.
Well, and that's why we're doing this, is to get the different perspective.
I'm not sure.
Go ahead, Alvis.
You know, one way that I look at futurists is that they are professional, or they are more or less, you know, simulators over time. You know, that the job of a good futurist is to build up time, you know, or, you know, simulate tunnels of time, and to be more accurate at that, and to present these simulations back into the global brain, back into the collective consciousness. Now, so it's interesting that you bring that up. I also think that, you know, that when I use the term... Oh, please continue.
Alice, go ahead.
So when I, you know, when I use the term simulation, you know, it's not... Oh, sorry. Are you guys able to hear me okay?
Yeah. Yes, please go ahead.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
We can hear you, Alvis. Go ahead.
I think I'm having here. You hear me?
Okay. I think we're having technical difficulties, Alvis.
I must just be having a lag hearing you guys. So here I am, you know, without that part of my simulation.
You know, it's interesting.
Well,
I think the way he's explaining it makes sense to me.
To close off that point, my idea of simulation extends to all these other fields. To these aesthetics, it's not...
Okay.
I think we got you, Alvis. Thanks for clarifying that. And how cool that he's talking about these simulations of the future, these predictions of the future, how as futurists we have to put together these simulations of the future, and thanks to the wonders of technology, it kind of sounds like he's talking to us from the future, just a little bit.
See, I like the term simulation rather than scenario. I always say scenario for the future. But I think simulation is more apt, don't you?
I think it's a very powerful idea that in fact what we're doing is modeling the future, that we're building little pictures of what it will be. I think it's a terrific idea. I do like the word scenario, but it seems like they both might have a good application. Reichert, what do you think about the idea of simulation as a strategy for thinking about the future?
Well, this conversation is so meta for me, it's I don't even know where to begin. But I'll hit on a few key points that come to my mind. So obviously all humans have a built-in simulator. Actually, in theory, all animals do as well, specifically mammals. Memory is a bad simulator. It fundamentally brings back up and makes you believe that you've seen or known things. And depending on how you do that, you can mess up those memories. I personally actually don't dream. I'm not aware of dreaming. I've had REM testing. I've grown up my whole life not being aware of what it's like to dream. I wake up having gone to sleep a moment later and refreshed. That's all I know. So when people talk to me about dreams, it's really fascinating to me because I'm actually a little fearful of other people's dreams, because when they describe them, they often describe them as if, A, they're real, and B, they people, of course, I'm sure all of you guys have experienced this, someone has said something is true, and you realize, no, they're insane, they've dreamt this in some form, or they've come to believe something, or they feel an emotion as a result of this, and this is because their simulator isn't working correctly from my point of view. And I think today the Greek playwrights of Greece are today writers for Star Trek, and we play out our stories and what's going on now in that venue and in science fiction and on television and so forth and movies. There was an episode I think once where an entire civilization was thrown into a little computer box or something, and they were to live out their lives in a pseudo simulator of sorts, but alive, as they refer to it. Simulation is a tricky concept. I've built simulators for the military, and you know, it's fascinating trying to build something that to a given human being is perceived as real. A very good, an old friend of mine who used to be a jet fighter pilot, I brought him in one day to physically test out a system we had designed that modeled jet airplanes, and he picked it up, and if you saw his physical posture, it's really interesting. I don't know if anybody's ever been around fighter pilots or pilots in general, but they tend to be very calm people. You might notice it in like the astronauts. They move their eyes before they move their heads, or at least this is very obvious to me when I'm standing around them. I've actually worked with Buzz Aldrin and a few others, and they just stand very still. Most of what's going on is going on in their minds, and they look with their eyes first and then their heads. And so I have this gentleman sitting in my, or standing in my office in this case, was standing there, and he picked up the joystick, and he picked it up and stood with it. He held it with one hand and put the other hand on the joystick itself. And there was a whole bunch of people in the room who had been using and experiencing and educating themselves about the simulator. And he proceeded in within seconds, he's never touched the thing before, he proceeded to use it and kill everybody, just almost instantly. And everyone was stunned. There were 20-year-olds in the room and video game experts in the room and people who've actually won awards for video game playing. And here this guy walks in, starts to use this thing, immediately kills everybody, and so quickly. And he's standing there almost perfectly still. And we're like, wow, how did you do that? And he goes, well, I've been trained. And for him, while it is a simulator, what's really happening is there's a completely separate simulation going on in his head of all the maneuvers, of what he should be doing next. He's already pre-modeling everything that's going on at such a rate, such an amazing rate, that even this, you know, piece of technology, and I mean that in a derogatory sense, as an annoyance as it was for him to use it as a manifestation of something he's done physically, was still just a really interesting experience for us. And of course, he puts the joystick down, and he begins to describe to me in the most amazingly articulate way exactly what was wrong with the physics of the jet. He could describe to me exactly how it wasn't pulling up on the nose as he was descending at a higher speed, and he could tell me how the air turbulence was missing and he was noticing this. And he just described all of the deltas from what he perceived as his reality of how this should really work. So now we get to just one simple concept, which is resolution of simulation. And part of our resolution of simulation, the problem with Alvis is that that resolution is being squelched by low bandwidth. Some of the processes in the background are, a lot of people are jumping onto Google right this moment, wherever he is. And you know, our simulators require a certain amount of information to become real to us. And so I guess for the future, and again, the question is a bit meta for me, so I'm trying to stay locked onto it, which is when I describe all these things I've just mentioned about simulations and how we perceive the environment around us, I look at it from this point of view. All things we can acclimate to, especially if you're young enough, and we will. We will make use of everything around us because we start with the simulator that's in our mind where we imagine something, and the moment we can imagine, and I use the word can very specifically here, the moment we can imagine us doing something, we can do it. And so I'll mention just one last study that I remember many years ago that really fascinated me and caused me to change the way I did things. Multiple sets of groups were taken aside and introduced to the game basketball, having never played it before. One group was allowed to physically play and test themselves for a day or so. The other group was forced to sit in a room and talk about it, think about it, imagining themselves winning. And then they were pitted against each other to see who won. And the people who imagined it often did better than the people who had been physically playing it. And that could be because they were not worn out. I'm not sure about the actual test metrics. But the concept was just really fascinating to me, that if you can imagine doing it, then it's real for you. And I think that's a heavy part of how we will brand this concept for people in the future, which is, it, sort of I'm not an Apple cult member, but I do love the Think Different Lee, as it should be said, campaign. Yes, if you can imagine it, it can be real. This has great truth to it. Not in the type of books that come out right now, which tell you if you can imagine money, it'll come to you. I'm talking about if you can imagine yourself and how you would interact with things that you can see other people doing and working. At least that makes it a reality for you.
One of the interesting observations that I made about memes that really catch on, that really capture the public imagination. One of them is this idea of the law of attraction, and this notion that people have, which you sort of referenced there at the end, this idea that they have, that they can imagine something and that's going to influence the universe and make something happen. And you know, that is actually a shorthand and bogus version. That's the cargo cult version of what you're talking about there, which is this process whereby what's in the human imagination becomes manifest in the external world. That's what we actually do through technology and through society, through our interactions as beings on this planet. So it's really interesting to think about how the barriers between imagination and reality get broken down because of the accelerating changes that we're talking about here. And one of the things that I think people have to get a grip on is just how powerful that is. That what we think about can become reality in very unexpected ways. Because we will be, we have the capability of making that happen. I'm not talking about anything spooky, but just simply through the fact that we're becoming very adept at taking what we have inside of our heads and putting that out into the world.
I think a good example of that, Phil, is what we see on, when we go to the movies now. Pretty much, if it can be imagined, it can be put on screen. And
that's exactly right. Yeah.
From a visual standpoint, right? Yeah, from a visual standpoint. Well, if we can visualize it, then we're one step close to actually making it work in our reality. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So, Michael, I'm gonna go. Sorry, go ahead, Record.
This is Alvis. I think I'm back here on a cell phone. If you guys can hear me, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, we got you. Sounding good. Go ahead.
Excellent. So, you know, I think those points are great, and you know, and when we're extrapolating the, you know, the longer term accelerating future, you know, that's why we're also starting to encounter, you know, new theories, new simulations, like, you know, Nick Bostrom postulating that maybe we are being simulated, you know, physicists and scientists simulating that we're, you know, I think as you pointed out in one of your posts, Phil, you know, that we're the universe is, you know, consists of 11 dimensions. All these things that, you know, seem totally magical because we're able to, you know, apply science, take information, turn it into convert it into a simulational format that we can then, you know, tell other people about. You know, this stuff is all explosive, and it is this counter to, you know, I think to this, you know, strong AI singularity, you know, scenario that many futurists, you know, seem to be in alignment with, you know, this idea that it's going to be taken out of our hands. You know, there's something that's going to be able to be such a better simulator of everything than we are. When in fact, if we look at these accelerating curves, we see that we're, you know, that we as humans, and, you know, with our own simulational ability, are actually kind of at the heart of this intelligence increase. And so that can bode well. For us, and it certainly is very, very difficult to grasp. You know, when I have conversations with a lot of people about, you know, this stuff, it takes quite a few steps to be able to transmit my simulation of that, if you will, to them. So.
Well, now, do you make them sick the way Reichert does? I guess that's the real question. We can pick that one back up some other time. Okay, well, we're winding quickly down here, just about out of time. So, Michael, I just wanted to know, were there any pressing questions from the chat room? We really haven't had too much opportunity to interact with our chatters this evening, although I know that we've had a lively chat going on. Anything from the chat room that needs to get into the on-air discussion before we close it out?
Well, I'm going to read something that wasn't a question, but then the question that got asked in response to this would be the question. From Jeff, humans promoting an increasing context of increasingly coherent, hierarchical, fine-grained values via methods increasingly effective in principle over an increasing scope of interactions. Lather, rinse, repeat. To which Sally J. asked, okay, so the universe has hologram.
And so is there a question there, or?
Universe has hologram question mark. I guess I didn't inflect up well enough. But it was more of a discussion in the chat tonight than a breeder of questions for the panel.
Okay, well, I like it. As distinct from a question, it's a statement of the sort that makes everyone sit back and go, whoa. But I think what Sally's getting at there is the simulation argument, the notion that the entire universe itself might be a simulation. And in fact, we will be getting to that later on in this series of programs. So, Sally, if you stay tuned with us a few weeks down the road, we actually are going to spend an entire hour talking about that and talking about this move to a new substrate that Alvis referenced earlier. So thank you for that, and thanks to everyone in the chat room this evening. We enjoy seeing such a lively chat going on. Great stuff there. All right, with the remaining time that we have, I'm going to just very quickly round robin with our panel and see if folks have any parting thoughts on the subject of our thinking, anything that you wanted to say about where it needs to go, how thinking needs to change, or anything related to the topics that we've touched on tonight that you didn't get a chance to say earlier. And we'll just start with Reichert.
I just heard I'm now in the host queue. What does that mean?
We can hear you all
fine. I think I just left the simulator. There's one quick thing, and this actually came up, and it'll sound sort of tangential to everything we're talking about, but it's actually directly connected to how I feel about how people think and where the future is going. And it was the people complaining about China and their censorship rules and how horrible everything is over there. And I'm a big Lenny Bruce fan, and so I ask, you know, of our own people here in America, the country I'm not from but I love, and I'm deeply patriotic, and I want this country to win, if there is a win to happen here. But the only way we're going to win is by changing ourselves. I'd like to see our top, you know, 7 censorship words removed. I'd like to see every level of censorship removed and a completely different philosophy in how we approach that problem. So as long as we stop one thing, one piece of information, one comedian, poor David Letterman, who had to give a forced apology because the fact is, he has to, you know, pay the bills, and when his advertisers pull it out from underneath them, he has to go on television and apologize to somebody who got bent out of shape over a joke. The moment we allow that to happen, we have no ability to complain about anybody else. So now apply that to any forward-thinking idea, and we have to prove it ourselves. Each one of us, of course, has to demonstrate to other people the quality that has been improved in our lives. And then separately, we have to demonstrate it in terms of how it can be applied for them. We unfortunately carry the burden of teaching other people how to learn. That's my summarization.
Very good. Okay, great. Next, Natasha.
You know, he just brought up something that I was sitting here thinking about, the risks of people out of control in North Korea's Kim Jong-il and Iran's Mohammad Ahmadinejad are high-profile examples of the ways things can go awry and how marvelous it is that we do have an opportunity to voice our views regardless of these things going awry. But the future is always unsettling because it has the great unknown, and no one really enjoys having to change what we are already comfortable with. In my closing, I wanted to just touch lightly on your site, The End of Scarcity and the Age of Abundance. And I was thinking about the term abundance, and I just wonder if an age of an abundance may be too fixed on society's excesses, too much quantity. I wonder if it might be better or wiser perhaps to see an age of quality. There's so much more value in elegant style than a draw full of stuff. Thinking of another comedian with the stuff, George Carlin, and his act on stuff and all the stuff we have and where we put it. But I would rather see each every person have enough to live a healthy, loving life and then streamline all the extras when we become multiple identities and multiple substrates. We won't be thinking of abundance because we will be within the era of instantaneous existence. So that is my closing thought here. And I just enjoyed this so much. It was great fun to be with you all, and it was stimulating, and the time passed so quickly. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful having you on again, Natasha, and thank you for that rather profound thought there at the end. Not that the others weren't profound as well, but quite a concept you leave us with there. Okay, Alvis, you get the final word of the final words.
Excellent. So, I think is very similar once again to the summaries that are presented by Rutger and Natasha. This idea of unlearning who we are, you know, being comfortable with the idea that our values and our simulation of ourself is going to change, and it's going to change radically. You know, until we can more accurately define what a human is, what intelligence is, you know, what is empathy? You know, what are these processes? How do they relate to global evolutionary, universal and cosmic systems, and larger processes. I think my words of advice to listeners would be to embrace learning and unlearning stuff so that we can more quickly achieve consensus and thus evolve and develop more accurate, visions of what it's going to take for us as a species to cooperate, to survive, to act in a positive sum manner, and I think it's imperative that we extend these ideas to all these disconnected regions like North Korea, like a lot of underdeveloped areas. You know, as Thomas Barnett says, the danger zones in the world are disconnected areas. Areas that don't have a lot of communications infrastructure. It's no accident that the Taliban, banned televisions in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So if we can all become better simulators and better simulation helpers for our fellow man, then I think we're going to be heading in the right direction, and we're also going to be able to do it in a more balanced way that's going to prevent a lot of harmful disruption and hopefully allow the system to kind of steward us. Final note, I had a blast. This was a wonderful conversation. So thanks to you all.
Well, thank you, Alvis. Thank you, Natasha. Thank you, Reichert. What a pleasure talking to all three of you. I hope that we'll have you back on again sometime very soon. And now, Stephen, before our time expires, what is our music this evening?
The song is Daylight Dreaming by Porter Block, who's coming. This is a return of that particular artist to the show, so look forward to hearing this.
All right, Porter Block singing Daylight Dreaming. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you, Michael. All our friends in the chat room, once again, thanks to our guests and everyone listening. We appreciate your participation, and we look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio, live next week with Aubrey de Grey. Until then, live to see it.
In the